calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live, coast to coast, all across this great nation, and frankly, streaming all around the planet on RadioPower.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, AirAmericaRadio.com, on radio stations from coast to coast, on Sirius Satellite Radio. Welcome to our program. Oil above $70 a barrel again. Gold still above $600 an ounce. Strange things happening economically. The head of the WTO in the news today in the Wall Street Journal, we're going to be getting into that. One of the leading health insurance companies now, his CEO just made over $1 billion. That's with a B, over $1,000 million. Who's worth this kind of money? It's amazing. We're going to just the whole economic picture at the same time in Iraq. Strange stuff going on in Iraq. While, by the way, we're having rolling blackouts in Houston in April. In April? A sign of things to come. And at the same time in Baghdad, street battle smack of open civil war. This is from Reuters. So a lot going on today that we will be getting into during the next 3 hours. Welcome to our program. We're going to start out with Michael LeGault. Michael LeGault is the author of Think, Why Crucial Decisions Can't Be Made in the Blink of an Eye. Sort of the anti-blink book, eh, Michael? Michael, welcome to the program.
Point for the book, anyway.
Say it again.
It's the starting point. It's not the whole ball of wax, but it does start with that.
Now, in your book, you identify these five greatest media myths, and we're going to just take one of them to discuss today. But I'll just so people know. One, you say global warming is a media myth. You say that women earning less money than men is a media myth. That we're running out of oil is a media myth. That man-made as opposed to naturally occurring carcinogens are a huge threat to humankind is a media myth. And finally, the one we're going to discuss today, that the trade deficit will destroy America's economy. Am I characterizing your writing correctly?
Well, these are actually some of the things I mentioned in the book, but a couple of them are over and above that. They're, talking points that relate to the main thesis of the book.
I see. Okay. So you're suggesting that the fact that every year we buy from the rest of the world $800 billion worth of stuff, and we don't sell to the world $800 billion worth of stuff, that's the difference between what we buy and sell, and therefore we have to allow other companies, we have to do one of two things. We have to either borrow money from other countries to sustain that, or we have to sell off our nation to them. We sold off Chrysler to the Germans, for example. You know, we've got companies from other countries coming in and building auto factories here. You know, Toyota's building automobiles here in the United States, taking all the profits back to Japan. You see that as a good thing?
Oh, no, I don't see it necessarily as a good thing, but I think it's the difference here, as I'm trying to point out, is an issue versus an alarmist sort of take on it. And there's a number of ways to look at this which aren't necessarily gloom and doom. And one of them is that, first of all, Americans just have a lot of money to spend, and they have a lot of disposable income, so they end up buying goods made from foreign countries. And secondly,
Wait a second. Before we go on to your second point, yeah. Michael, and we certainly will, why would I want to... I think you just suggested that I'm walking around with a little extra money in my pocket, and so I say, gee, I got some extra money in my pocket. I think I want to buy something made outside the United States. That doesn't make any sense.
No, I'm not suggesting that. I'm just saying that is the reality that we live in a global economy, is that most of a large portion of the goods that are made are made outside of the country now. And so,
right, but that's not because consumers decided that they wanted stuff made outside the United States.
That's because
manufacturers found that there was cheap labor outside the United States, and they could be more profitable making things in China than making them in the United States, and so they shipped our jobs overseas.
Yeah, well, and that's one of my points in my book, why it's more important than ever that we build a knowledge base of, we improve our educational system, because that's all we have to rely on nowadays is knowledge. We can't
If that's all we have to rely on, Michael LeGault, maybe you can answer this question that just really baffles me.
Sure.
I got an email the other day from a guy, and this is characteristic, frankly, typical of calls and emails that I get whenever we talk about this topic, who is an engineer. He's got a master's degree in engineering, in computer engineering. His last three jobs over the last 5 years, all three of them ended up being outsourced to India. He is now in the process of training the people in India who are going to replace him. They're shutting down the entire IT department at his company, an IT department that had nationwide over 500 employees 5 years ago. And now they're down to about 8 or 10 of them, and they're shutting the whole thing down and sending it over to India on January 1st. He knows his job is going to be gone. He's 52 years old, and he's toast. Now, what's he supposed to train for?
Well, you know, it goes back to the creative destruction of what capitalism is about. I guess you could say if you don't like it, then you know maybe it's time that we start relocating over to India and China. I mean, that's just the way of the world, and I don't see how you can stop it.
We stopped it for 210 years in the United States with tariffs. We said capitalism is fine within certain limits, but also laissez-faire capitalism is, you know, based on a fundamental myth that property rights trump human rights, and we're going to say no, human rights trump property rights. And
so, if
a corporation can make something cheaper overseas, we're going to charge them an import tax when they bring that product into the United States so that they're going to keep their jobs here. And it worked fine right up until Ronald Reagan came into office.
Well, it's a slippery slope, though, Tom. I mean, they can do the same
target. They built the greatest industrial power in the world.
They can do the same targets. And so, you know.
And they do. I mean, right now, no, seriously, Michael, China has a 25% import tariff on automobiles made in the United States. If GM wants to sell a car in China, they have to pay a 25% import tariff. On the other hand, if China wants to import a car into the United States, we have a 1.8% import tariff on automobiles.
Well, and I don't agree with that. In fact, one of the problems that we have with the global free trade agreements is that inequities have been built into these trade agreements in terms of subsidies and tariffs. And unfortunately, the United States went into a lot of these agreements and agreed to these types of situations. I have a situation here in Canada where I'm based, even though I'm a U.S. citizen, where the U.S. is imposing an import duty on softwood lumber. It has the Canadians going crazy. In fact, their lumber is subsidized by the government, but it, in fact, was agreed to within the trade agreement to allow those types of subsidies. So that's
so
the kind of
pickle we've got. So what's wrong with a country? What's wrong with, you know, we the people collectively getting together and saying, you know, we've decided that it's more important for us to manufacture our steel here than it is for us to have the world's cheapest steel. Even if it's going to cost a little bit more for the manufacturers, even though we may not be competitive, we want to have steel manufacturing here because someday we may need to fight a war and our steel suppliers may say, sorry, you can't have any more steel. Or computer chips. I mean, fill in the blanks. We can't build a missile right now without parts from China, and yet China is threatening us with nuclear war.
Well, you know, I think what this requires, and I don't think it's feasible to go back to a world with lots of trade barriers, but I would argue that we need to level the playing field in terms of those types of tariffs like you're talking about in China that exist or in Japan, and so that America can compete on it.
But you haven't answered my question, Michael. What's wrong with a country saying there are some industries, and maybe even a large swath of them, because they're the things that prop up the middle class, there are some industries that we are not going to allow to go overseas?
Nothing theoretically. But
well, what theoretically is opposite, it is capitalism, saying, no, capital is more important than the will of the people.
Well, is it the will of the people? I mean, have we taken a vote on this? I mean, has it been put to the ballot? I don't know. I mean, I hear, right now in this country there exists protectionist sort of slants within the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. So I think it's an issue that crosses all political boundaries. But I don't see people marching out on the street.
But what's wrong with it? Whether people are marching or not, I would say they are. I would say what you're seeing is you're seeing people dying, you know, across this country as a consequence of it. You're seeing 46 million people uninsured in this country and thousands of deaths as a consequence of that because people are terrified that if they lose their job, they'll lose their insurance, and if they get sick, they're going to die. And it's not a funny thing.
No, well, listen, you know, I mean, in terms of, and we'll get back to my point.
And you living in Canada don't have that problem.
There's poverty in Canada, too, but it's
but you're not going to be wiped out by illness. Because you have national health insurance.
And I don't think people are.
But back to the question, Michael. What's wrong with a country saying we're going to protect our industries, other than the fact that Walmart can't make more money?
I said in theory nothing's wrong with it, but I don't see a groundswell of support for it.
No, but you oppose it.
What?
You oppose it. You're in favor of absolute free trade, right?
I am in favor of free trade, but free trade that is fair. And I don't think at this point in time you can say we have fair free trade. around the world, as you
fair
as
to
you
whom?
Pointed out.
I mean, is it fair to the middle class to say your job has gone to Taiwan because people there are willing to work for $4 an hour and you want $7?
I would say that if it is if there is a rational economic rationale, then capital flows to the place where it's cheapest to make the product.
Michael Legault, he's the author of Think: Why Crucial Decisions Can't Be Made in the Blink of the Eye, or Blink of an Eye. Michael, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. It's 16 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartmann radio program. You're in the center of the vast liberal conspiracy. Take no imitations, my friends.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartmann.
Oh, but ain't that America, you and me? Ain't that America, something to see, baby? Ain't that America, home of the free, yeah? Little pink houses for you and me.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartmann radio program, speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone here in Little Bay Root, the People's Republic of Portland, Oregon. In 1975, Jimmy Carter was president. The U.S. export, no, actually, was that? No, it was Jerry Ford. Jerry Ford was president in 75, as I recall. U.S. exports, this was the last year that we had a real trade surplus in the United States, $12 billion. And now, trade deficits as far as the eye can see. At the same time, in today's Wall Street Journal today, that little redundancy, the Department of Redundancy Department there, in today's Wall Street Journal, oil settles above $70 a barrel despite inventories at eight-year high. Now, this is a really interesting thing. It has been assumed that the reason why the price of oil is going up is because there is more demand for it or there is less supply. And there is some truth to that. However, there's also something new on the horizon. There are these things called exchange-traded funds, EFTs. And they're a symptom of a larger gestalt, a larger context, a larger phenomenon, which is that investors are moving their money out of the stock market and out of mutual funds and into commodities. Now, when I talk about investors, the thing that it provides some stability to the stock market are these huge pension funds that are invested in the stock market and the large quantities of 401ks and other, basic retirement funds, savings accounts that Americans have that are parked in stocks. And it's one of the reasons why when the stock market goes down, it's not, in all probability, going to go down the way it did in 1929. It's going to be a slow, gradual, long hemorrhage, in all probability. And part of the and one of the early canaries in the canaries in the cage in the mine, in the coal mine, is that the investors in the know are moving their assets into commodities like oil, gold, silver, copper, platinum, palladium. And in fact, here in the Wall Street Journal today, crude oil closed above $70 a barrel for the first time, highlighting a phenomenon reshaping the petroleum world. Investment flows into oil futures. In other words, people betting on the price of oil, basically. People buying oil as an investment, not to use, but as an investment. Investment flows into oil futures are supplanting nitty-gritty supply and demand data as prime drivers of prices. You get this? This is pretty significant. The fact that the thing that is maintaining price is the demand for oil from people who actually want to invest in it rather than use it. They say, in contrast to past bull markets in crude, this year's run-up has occurred even though oil inventories in the U.S., the world's largest market, have swelled to their highest levels in nearly 8 years. The answer to the puzzle posed by rising prices and inventories, industry analysts say, lies not only in supply constraints such as the Iraq war and the civil unrest in Nigeria, and the broad upswing in demand caused by the industrialization of China and India. Increasingly, they say, prices are also being guided by a continuing rush of investor funds into oil markets. Institutional money managers are holding between $100 billion and $120 billion in commodities investments, at least double the amount 3 years ago and up from $6 billion in 1999, says Barclays Capital, a securities unit of Barclays PLC. In other words, in the year before Bush became president, only $6 billion was invested in commodity, in oil, basically, and other commodities. And now it's over $100 billion. I would say that that's a trend. Now, they point out we're the world's largest oil market, accounting for nearly a quarter of world demand. The U.S., 5%, 4.5% of the world's population. We use 25% of the world's oil. But and analysts note that inventories in the rest of the world increasingly matter as China and India, two big and growing economies, join Japan and Europe as major users of oil. But our inventories, our U.S. inventories, are really high. Now, does that mean that the oil market is going to crash? They said the last time U.S. inventories were set at today's levels in 1998, the market was about to crash. By the end of 98, prices fell below $11 a barrel from an average of $18 a barrel. But they note a crash looks unlikely now, both because supplies remain tight and because of the large volumes of money that investors are pouring into oil markets. In other words, we have a speculation-driven market here. Money managers such as pension funds are investing in commodities to diversify away from stocks. Is this a Dutch tulip bulb phenomenon? Is this one of those things where, you know, everybody wants to get in simply because everybody else is getting in? I remember when gold went up to 800 back in the 70s. I mean, it was that kind of thing. There was this frantic desire to buy into the market. I've got to get it because it's going up. And yet at the same time, OPEC just released information on oil. They said that the average global oil demand grew by almost 1 million barrels a day in 2005, OPEC said. Average of 83.1 million barrels throughout 2005. And 2006 grew by 1.4 million barrels per day. And at the same time, oil production from the OPEC 11 nations that make up OPEC down 200,000 barrels as of March. So it could be both factors. 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back, my friends, to the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where despair is not an option. Get active, even in the face of...
So I hear the voices, and I read the front page, and I know the speculation, but I'm the decider, and I decide what is best.
I'm the decider, and I decide what is best. Yeah, yeah. Don't you get that? Whether it's Iraq or, something else.
You said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
I'm the decider. I'm going to decide about Rumsfeld. I'm going to decide about the war. I'm the decider. Don't you get it? So, Michael Toth wonders out loud, could the U.S. be prodding Iran in an effort to inflate oil prices, seeing that this administration has such close ties to the oil industry and taking in consideration Osama bin Laden's conditions, oil prices over $100 a barrel. My recollection is it was $200 a barrel. He says it wouldn't surprise me. Based on the recent past, where oil prices would escalate anytime there's mere talk of instability, yeah, I think that that's helping to drive it. And, Michael, thank you for that. The U.S. retail price of gasoline shot up 10 cents over the last week to an average $2.78 a gallon. Again, what is driving all this? What is driving the increase in the price of oil is, and according to the Wall Street Journal and a lot of analysts here, is that people, investors, are fleeing into commodities, into real physical things, as opposed to stocks, which are more or less meta
things, and they're buying actual physical things. They're buying, you know, 100,000 barrels of oil or 1 million barrels of oil or, you know, 500 pounds of gold or whatever it is. You know, these wealthy investors are moving into commodities. And why? Because they are looking at the Bush administration policies, the domestic policies, the domestic taxation policies, and the international trade policies, and saying, these guys are absolutely flat-out nuts. They're destroying the United States of America, and I'm not going to have my money invested in the stocks of a company that's going down the tubes. I'm going to buy something that I can sell anywhere in the world, oil, gold, platinum, silver. That's what these people are saying, in my opinion. I mean, that's what the market is telling us. Here also today in the Wall Street Journal, the head of the World Trade Organization, the WTO head. This is the guy who runs the world. Did you know? You ever hear of Pascal Lamy? Or maybe it's L-A-M-Y. I mean, I have not heard of this guy that I'm not sure how to pronounce his last name. I mean, when was the last time you heard him in the news? This guy is the head of the World Trade Organization. He runs the world. I mean, sure, basically, economically, and economically, you bring down any country you want, and that's the end of that government, that's the end of that country. You can do more damage nowadays with economics than you can with bombs. And he's trying to drive through a global deal to cut trade tariffs, says Scott Miller in today's Wall Street Journal. A deal would be worth up to $100 billion to the global economy. Now, that's code language for all the corporations out there, according to the World Bank estimate. But it would require the U.S., European Union, Brazil, India, and others to accept fresh cuts and protections for their most sensitive industries. Pressure is building on Mr. Lamy to break the impasse. And so, you know, he's trying to do this. He's trying to jawbone these guys. Now, why is the pressure building on the head of the WTO to get the United States and all these other countries to do away with all their barriers to trade? So that all jobs can be outsourced to the country of cheapest labor, so that maximum multinational corporate profits can be realized by all multinational corporations all over the world, regardless of national boundaries, and to hell with the middle class of any individual country. Why is he experiencing this pressure? Well, as Scott Miller writes in the Wall Street Journal today, while the trade minister's April deadline was self-imposed, many diplomats believe they need to strike the outlines of a deal by the end of July. That would leave just enough time to crunch the final numbers and allow the White House, Bush, yes, to usher the pact through Congress, the Republicans, before President Bush's fast-track trade powers expire in July of 2007. After that, Congress would be able to pick any deal apart. End of quote from the Wall Street Journal. So they're trying to get this all through before July of next year, because at that point, Bush loses his fast-track authority. He loses the ability to jam through these trade deals without Congress having the right to line item deal with them. In fact, they note a collapse of the Doha round would likely trigger a rush to strike bilateral trade deals, scaling back the role of the World Trade Organization. In other words, if they can't say, okay, we're the ones who rule world trade, we're the ones who set the rules, there are no barriers except those defined by the World Trade Organization for the benefit of multinationals. If they can't do that, then what's going to happen is countries are going to cut deals between and among each other. And the WTO gets out of the loop. And the WTO is the new world order that George Herbert Walker Bush so lovingly talked about and that Bill Clinton brought us with signing NAFTA and GATT, which created the WTO, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, 440-THOM, Chris in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Oh, I'm doing pretty good. I love your show, Tom.
Thank you. Thank you. You're listening on Sirius Satellite Radio, it looks like.
Yeah, I'm on Sirius, and I'm telling you, it's the number one reason why I'm glad I got it is because of your show.
Well, thank you. So that's not what you called about, though.
No, not at all. I think a lot of people are forgetting the other side of the equation here. Yes, corporations need to make profit, but they are actually, surprisingly, taking a longer-term view. Capitalism, by its very nature, requires growth in order to survive. Growth is predicated upon the ability to have consumers buy your products. If Americans and Western civilization can't maintain that growth, they got to look elsewhere for consumers. And outside of Western countries, you have a lot of countries that just don't have the money to buy the products. So in essence, they are taking a chance. They're bootstrapping these other countries by outsourcing, giving them an income for which they can then buy and become consumers of the products.
Right, and the hope is that eventually, or at least this is how it was sold to us, eventually those countries are going to have large middle classes that are going to want to buy products made in the United States. But in the meantime, the United States stops making things.
Exactly, because their view is totally, I guess you could say, anti-nationalistic. They
right.
they don't look at it as a national issue.
Right, this is the ultimate one-world government.
Well, they don't care about the government either. They only care about the profits.
Well, it's the ultimate one-world governance, then, because it's governance by multinational corporations, and the highest law is the law of profit.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, well said, Chris. Well said. Thank you very much. Good to hear from you. Brian in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. Hey, Brian.
Hey, Tom. Just calling a quick comment, quick question. The comment, I really enjoyed the last interview. Thought it was excellent. There was a couple of times it was kind of funny. I think you made a Freudian slip. You confused country with corporation a couple of times. I just found
well,
that.
it's increasingly getting difficult to tell.
Oh, no,
apart.
No. That's why I said it was a Freudian slip, because it was poignant. It was funny.
Yeah.
My question is, you're talking about all these things going on with the gold market and the oil market. Am I paranoid to want to go out there and like start stocking up on water and canned food?
I don't think so.
Okay, thank you.
I mean, I don't think so. I'm not ready to go out
not
and become
excellent.
A Mormon, but
yeah.
No,
okay.
I don't think so. Thanks a lot.
Thanks
a lot, Brian. Good to hear from you. You know, in fact, with the possibility of bird flu epidemics, you know, our own government is recommending people have, you know, months worth of food around. Or at least a few weeks worth of food, I guess they're saying. And, but the bottom line, ultimately, though, Brian, is that we are interdependent. None of us can stand alone. And there might be a few farmers left in the United States who could stand alone, but very, very few. It's not like the day of my wife's grandmother, who literally didn't. You know, they knew the Great Depression was going on, but it didn't touch them because they had 100 acres in Michigan. They had a farm. They were completely self sufficient. And Grandma, you know, every year would buy a dress from Sears and a couple of pounds of sugar, and that was it. You know, and some salt. And those days are gone. And because we're interdependent, we need to be working on the interdependent systems. Deanna in Sacramento, California. Hey, Deanna.
Hi, Tom. Love your show.
Thank you so
much for what you do. Yeah. Hey, I just have a comment in regard to the gas prices. You know, here in California, as you know, we do extra to our gas for the clean air quality, and we're willing to pay for that for the most part. And periodically, you know, over the years, we'd see spikes in our gas, and they would justify it on the news by saying, you know, it's for maintenance. We had a refinery that went down or this or that. And they're constantly making me so mad because it's like, why am I paying for their maintenance and for their the part of doing business that actually most Americans take in that. And my point is, it's like if I had like a convenience store on the corner and my soda machine went down that day, I can't go in the store and charge a dollar more for everything in the store to make up for my soda machine to buy a
right.
new one by the end of the week. You know what I mean?
Sure. What you have essentially are monopolies. I mean, these big oil companies have gotten so big and so powerful that they are monopolies. And, you know, where's Teddy Roosevelt where's Jimmy Carter when you need him? You know, the last president that we had to break up a monopoly was Carter breaking up AT&T. That's it. Nobody has gone after any of them since then. And the result is that, you know, our media is under the control of a small number of corporations, our oil industry. It's like, you know, it's really, really, really destructive, not only to democracy, but I would say over the long term, even to capitalism itself.
I agree. You know, in regard to the media thing, just to tap onto that, I think I've actually come up with a solution to that. We just kicked off baseball season. We just kicked off a number of other seasons that end in October. We should be in the media park, in the baseball park. We should be filling those parks with universal messages. Remember, like in the 70s, that John 3:16, he got so much media time at all those
yeah, you're right.
Baseball games.
Good, good point, Deanna. Yeah, we got to wrap it up there, but interesting point. Yes, time for citizen action. Good one. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Never say thank you to those who love many. Never say thank you to those who still play fair. Hallelujah, the meek shall inherit. Never say thank you to all you people out there. Hallelujah.
And welcome back. Helping you win the water cooler wars. Tom Hartman here in the real free speech zone. The Tom Hartman radio program, 9.5 minutes before the hour. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466. And Dean in Springfield, Illinois on the line. Hey, Dean.
Hello. Thanks for having me on your show, Tom.
Thanks for calling and listening.
I got a question about the American dollar. When I was a kid, my folks didn't make that much money, but what they did make, they could pay their bills and save the other half of their check. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were all barely making $100 a week, you know?
Yeah.
Things were cheaper, and I wondered, what can we do to get back to that standard? I know we were on the gold standard then, mm-hmm. and what can we do to get back to that realism?
We were theoretically on the gold standard. The reality is that we weren't on the gold standard. I mean, when Nixon abolished it in 72, as I recall, he was basically just stating what was rather than, you know, making new institution, in my opinion. But to get back to it, what we have to do is go back to the rules of the game of international trade that we had in the United States from 1787, when we passed the first tariff laws that said that for the specific protection of domestic industry. Dean, I'm gonna drop your call because there's a lot of road noise coming back at me.
Okay, sir.
You know, I got your question, and I'll answer it here real quick. Number one, we need to go back to saying if there's a dollar's worth of labor and a pair of shoes made in the United States and you can make that same pair of shoes in Malaysia for 10 cents, that's fine. You can do that. But when you bring those shoes into the United States, you're going to pay a 90-cent tax. It's called an import tariff. And we did that with all of our domestic industries. And the only things that we didn't have tariffs on were things that we didn't produce here in the early years, things that we wanted to import. In the early years, things like, for example, French wines. You know, we didn't have much of an import tariff on French wines in the late 1700s because we didn't have a wine industry in the United States developed at that point in time. And you know, just as one example. And so you decide what businesses, what industries you want to grow. And we grew clothing industry, we grew machine tools, we grew automobiles, all of these industries, TVs. I mean, we invented it. We made it here. And then came the free traders. And they were basically, I'd say, the free traders. They were basically saying, you know, it's more important that corporations make a profit than that these industries be protected and these middle-class jobs be kept here. And we're going to trade, you know, one middle-class job here for five cheap labor jobs in China. And, the corporation's going to make a more profit. The CEO is going to become a billionaire instead of just a millionaire. And so what? If a whole bunch of Americans have to work at McDonald's or Walmart, that doesn't matter. And that's the free trade religion of the Tom Friedmans, the Bill Clintons, and the George W. Bushes of the world. That's the Kool-Aid that they drank. And I think some of them are starting to wake up, but a lot of them are not. And that's you know, fundamentally going back to balanced budgets and rational trade policy. Very simple. Phil in Tampa Bay, Florida. Hey, Phil, what's up?
Hi. You know how after the election you're going to have all the talking heads analyze why this politician or that politician or this group or that group didn't win or did win. And I don't think we need to wait. Look, I can tell you right now. And there, you know, the various tactics that the Republicans have used to win elections. You made John Kerry look like a draft dodger, and you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, you take your opponent's strength and you turn that into their weakness.
Okay.
And then they're left with nothing.
The Democrats are going to lose. Not going to regain the House, and they're not going to regain the Senate. And I'm going to tell you the tactic. They are going to paint the Democratic Party as the party of open borders. They're going to say that if the Democrats get elected, you'll see 20 million people come from Honduras, Nicaragua, Mexico, other South America, China.
You're right, Phil. You're right. And in fact, they're already setting it up by saying that Harry Reid blew up the immigration bill in the Senate, when in fact the Senate is controlled by the Republicans. If the Republicans wanted it, they would have had it.
And that's how. And unfortunately, they're going to take video snips of Chairman Dean of the Democratic Party talking in Spanish to a crowd, and they're going to take video snips of Kennedy also speaking in Spanish when his real priority is helping the Irish people in Boston get status. and they're going to use that, and they're going to scare the hell out of the American people that it's going to be open borders, and people are going to lose their jobs.
Yeah. No, Phil, I got it, and I suspect, I'm not sure that the Democrats are going to lose even despite that, but I suspect that you're right, that will be the primary strategy the Republicans will use, and probably to some success. Thanks for the call. Phil in Espanola, New Mexico. Hey, Phil, what's up?
Hi, actually, it's Cliff.
Oh, Cliff, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. I'm a pretty big Frank Herbert fan, and there's a novel, I'm not sure you've read it, but it's called Dune.
Dune, oh yeah.
Yeah, so, and I was...
I read it as a teenager.
Yeah, I was thinking...
Worms on Mars, spice.
Yeah.
Sand.
Yeah. I was just thinking the analogies between our current situation and our dependence on, and their dependence in the novel on spice.
Right.
And just how necessary it was for an art time and in the novel itself. So,
yeah, you know, it's really funny. A good friend of mine, Jack Vance, a science fiction writer, he and Frank Herbert and Paul Anderson and Robert Silverberg and L. Ron Hubbard were building a boat in Oakland in the 1950s.
Jack told me this story.
Yeah, and they were sort of patronizing Frank Herbert, saying, you know, because he had this wacky idea about these worms on Mars, and they didn't think it would go anywhere, and he was the guy who got the richest out of all of them. And then Hubbard came up with this wacky idea of, you know, these people from outer space coming and seeding Earth and coming back, and he wrote an article for Amazing, and it got such a strong response he went off and started a religion based on it. And so they ended up with just three of them building the boat. But an interesting story. Cliff, I got to run along.
Okay.
Thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. And yes, interesting analogies there. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius Satellite Radio, streaming around the planet, radiopower.org, whiterosesociety.org, airamericaradio.com. Welcome back to our program. At the same time that George W. Bush this morning, juxtaposition. Bush comes out and says,
I have strong confidence in Don Rumsfeld. I hear the voices, and I read the front page, and I know the speculation, but I'm the decider, and I decide what is best, and what's best is for Don Rumsfeld to remain as the Secretary of Defense.
I'm the decider. And see, he's got a problem with the revolt among his generals. Edgar in Seattle sends me a note. He says, didn't Adolf Hitler also have a problem with dissenting generals, as does our leader Bush? If I remember correctly, those career military leaders grew so disgusted with the conduct of Germany's war that they eventually tried to kill their Führer, who would not listen to them. Now, nobody's recommending that, obviously. Rommel, for his role in the conspiracy, was given the option of suicide or to be disgraced by being murdered. Rommel chose to take his own life. The Bushites, on the other hand, will not give these dissenting generals the option not to be disgraced. These generals, who have so very reluctantly come forward to voice their concerns, are now being labeled as un-American and are being murdered by the orchestrated right-wing media. He says, keep up the good work. Resistance is not futile. Well said, Ed. Thanks a lot. We'll see how this thing shakes out. Speaking of resistance, a lot of people are starting to wonder about the pharmaceutical industry. And in fact, we'll be talking in a few minutes about William McGuire and what's up with his career. Right now, Kathleen Slattery Moskow is with us. She's made a new movie called Side Effects. SideEffectsTheMovie.com, the website. Kathleen, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
I watched the movie last night. In fact, Louise and I watched it together. It's just a marvelous film. It's a regular film, and yet it's also a documentary. Throughout the film, there are cutaways where instead of trying to insert into dialogue in ways that might seem kind of clunky, things like the fact that, you know, a pharmaceutical company is making $1 million an hour in profit, for example, you just, you know, flash a slide on the screen. So there's this really great love story and story of this woman, you know, becoming a pharmaceutical rep and and sort of a, you know, what happens when you tell the truth, what happens when you don't. I mean, there's all these kind of subplots in here. So there's a story, but there's also an almost documentary component to this. I know this is not a documentary. It's a film. But how is that being received?
You know, it's been great. I mean, the whole reason we decided to make a movie, an entertaining movie instead of a documentary, we actually did go on to make a documentary as well, but initially was to be able to reach a broad audience and entertain people and educate them along the way. So I think that is why people are having so much fun, because it's a romantic comedy. There's a lot of humor. There's some drama. There's some saucy scenes. So it's very entertaining, but people are walking away with their eyes wide open as to how the industry is, you know, marketing its drugs and what happens behind the scenes. And we as consumers and we as physicians need to know how this looks so we can all make better decisions over which pills we pop.
Now, what brought you to you personally to this, Kathleen Slattery Moscow, was your experience as a drug rep yourself.
Yeah,
they used to call them detail men.
I was a detail woman for 10 years. I sold pills for the pharmaceutical industry, and I was hired when I was 23, fresh out of college, political science major, no business. I had no business selling drugs to physicians, but over the course of that decade, you know, I really started to pay close attention to what was happening around me, and I became increasingly uncomfortable. But every time that I was just about to walk away, I'd say about 5 years in, I really started to feel uncomfortable in terms of the things I was told to say, some of the things I was told not to say, what was driving all the decisions. But every time I was just about to walk away, and this is the hardest thing for me to admit, but every time I was just about to walk away, I'd get a big fat raise or a new company car, and I'd find myself rationalizing all of the reasons to stay. Oh, but I'm doing such a benefit to society by educating doctors. And I find myself spinning it and selling out. I thought that was an important theme to kind of explore in the film as well.
Yeah, and you did a very good job of that. This young woman in this movie really goes through some interesting internal conflict and conflict in her relationship with her boyfriend, who was also a drug rep and decided that he was going to pack it in.
Right. He was a guy who walked his talk, and she was very, you know, that was very appealing to her. And honestly, we have to, you know, attribute so much of what comes off on the screen to the performance of Katherine Heigl, who just, you know, knocked our socks off in this role.
Oh, she's brilliant. She's brilliant. She's a brilliant actress.
And I think this is the first role. Obviously, we see her on Grey's Anatomy doing great stuff, but this is the first role, I think, that really shows off her range in terms of the physical comedy and the drama and just nailing the part of the character and the problems and issues she's going through.
Yeah. So where are you going with this movie? I mean, we're talking with Kathleen Slattery Moscow. She's the producer of SideEffectsTheMovie.com is the website, SideEffectsTheMovie.com. Literally, the movie called Side Effects. And, you know, watching this on the little screen on my TV, watching the DVD, I very much got the sense that this is a movie made for distribution in theaters. Are you doing a theater release on this, or are you doing
We've been in theaters. We've been doing. We're an independent film, so we're super low budget. But it's been. We've been really, you know, fortunate into how, you know, as to how well the film's been received. But we've been doing a slow rolling release throughout the country, one city at a time since September. And we actually have two major cities left: Chicago and LA at the beginning of May, and then we come to DVD on May 16th. So we've been taking it city by city because we're low budget indie, and it's very expensive to bring it to the theaters. But we've been really fortunate as to how, you know, well the film's been received everywhere.
Well, your production values are not low budget. I mean, watching the movie, you don't get a sense that you're watching a movie that was put together by anything less than, or you know, not to attach a value judgment to it,
sure,
but anything less than a major Hollywood studio.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
No, it's just really, really well done. So, Kathleen Slattery Moscow, Side Effects, the name of the movie. People go to the website, they can buy the movie, or they can get online for the movie. You said it's not going to come out in DVD until May?
It comes out May 16th. People can sign up right now to be on the DVD waiting list, and within the next week it'll be available to order, with the ship date being May 16th.
Okay. And your catbird seat into the pharmaceutical industry, I mean, you've seen the inside of this thing. You were in the inside of it.
Right.
You're now picking on them. I'm wondering what you see as the future of the pharmaceutical industry.
Well, I mean, obviously, they're kind of reaping what they sowed right now, everything that's happening with Vioxx and some of the different things that they're being exposed on right now. And I don't know that they're going to change, and I don't know if regulation is going to come down the line. So I think the first step in the right direction is to raise awareness and make sure the public and the doctors know what's going on behind the scenes, because they're not going to be able to do business as usual if we're not buying it anymore. And right now we're being bombarded with these beautiful drug ads 24/7, and we're marching into our doctor's offices in droves demanding these fancy designer drugs because they're so effective at the advertising. So we need to understand what this looks like, and that their number one goal is to shove more pills down our throats.
Right. There was one scene in the movie where they got the production cost down to 10 cents a pill, and so they jacked the retail price up to $12 a pill.
Yeah, it's insane, because they call those the cash cows. You know, right. those particular drugs are the cash cows.
Yeah, and Vioxx, of course, for a while was one of those things for Merck. And but what we're seeing, I think, increasingly is that the pharmaceutical industry is not. Well, maybe it is working very well. I was going to say it's not working the way it's supposed to, but they're certainly still very, very profitable. I think, for example, that most Americans think that the pharmaceutical industry spends more money on product development, on finding new drugs, than they do on advertising and marketing. Not true. I think most people think that the pharmaceutical industry is spending most of the money on research for drugs, when in fact most of the research on pharmaceuticals that come to market is actually paid for by taxpayers. It's done mostly by universities. The fundamental realities of the industry, how heavily subsidized it is by taxpayers, and how then they use that subsidy to rip us off, is unknown in America.
Yeah, it's insane.
Yeah, so hopefully more people will get the word. SideEffectsTheMovie.com. Kathleen Slattery, Moscow, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, A Pill That Will Help You Escape the Matrix.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I'm going one way, your way. It's just one way. Let's make it our way.
And welcome back, my friends. 20 minutes past the hour, telling the truths that multinational corporations would really rather you didn't know all about. Tom Hartman here with you. The Wall Street Journal today, front page, rewarding career is the subhead. The headlines, as patients and doctors feel a pinch, insurer CEO makes a billion. Billion! This is the story of William McGuire. He draws $8 million a year in salary plus bonus. This is by George Anders in today's Wall Street Journal. $8 million a year in salary plus bonus, enjoying perks such as personal use of the company jet. He also has amassed one of the largest stock option fortunes of all times, $1.6 billion. As the Wall Street Journal notes, Dr. McGuire's story shows how an elite group of companies is getting rich from this nation's fraying healthcare system. Many of them aren't discovering drugs or treating patients. They're middlemen who process the paperwork. Their executives are among the country's most richly paid, as doctors, patients, hospitals, and even drug makers are feeling a financial squeeze, and some 46 million Americans lack health insurance. And they tell the story of this guy, William McGuire, who is the CEO of United Health Group. And interestingly, on the Wall Street Journal online today, United Health posts 21% rise in net, lifts profit outlook. United Health Group, Inc., the nation's second biggest health insurer, said Tuesday its first quarter profit climbed 21% as revenue jumped 58%, propelled by the acquisition of Pacific Care and the addition of a Medicare drug benefit. Now, here's a mind-boggling thing. Now, first of all, they showed a profit, a three-month profit, quarterly profit of $899 million, 63 cents a share. Up from $743 million the previous quarter. So, first of all, you've got the company that is that is responsible for simply handling the payment for health care in this country. The second largest company in the United States that is simply responsible for making sure that your health care gets paid for. Making a $900 million profit over the last 3 months. They add in this Associated Press piece, UnitedHealth said 4.5 million seniors were using its Medicare Part D prescription drug benefit as of March 31st, generating $1.2 billion in revenue for the quarter. So you have to ask yourself the question. If this Part D prescription drug benefit, this Medicare prescription drug benefit that requires one of these for-profit health insurance companies to be in the middle of it, if it generated $1.2 billion for this company, which has just given $1.6 billion to their CEO, what could we do in this country if you and I kept that money? What could we do in this country if that money was available to actually pay for health? In fact, as they say in the Wall Street Journal, and this article, front page article today, quoting again from the Wall Street Journal, the arrival of the $1 billion CEO would be a head turner in any industry, but it's especially controversial in healthcare, where, as Jonathan Weiner, a health policy expert at Johns Hopkins University, said, people tend to view each dollar of executive pay as money that isn't spent on them. So, you know, how did this guy make all this money? How is it that he ended up with $1.6 billion? And at the same time, his company is showing record profits. Well, obviously, they're able to do it because the money's coming out of your pocket and mine. If we had a national health care system, this company would not exist. They would simply be made redundant by the existence of the national health care system. So, you know, who is paying this guy? Well, let's take a look at this. The board of directors of United Healthcare, if you go to theyrule.net, and you choose, and you go to companies and you choose United Health Group, there's a list of all the directors. And for example, we see Thomas Keene is on the board of directors of United Healthcare. Okay, you following along? Thomas Keene, the guy who was on the 9/11 commission, Republican. He's also on the board of directors of Pepsi. And he's also on the board of directors of CIT Group and of Aramark. Okay, we also, looking through the board, you also see, let's go through the list here. James Johnson, and you click on companies, and he's also on the board of Temple Inland and KB Home and Gannett Newspapers. And what is this company here? Target. And William Spears is on the board. He's the only guy on this board. Let's see. One, two, three. Some of these guys are on multiple boards. Here we go. Douglas Leatherdale is on Xcel Energy's board. Gail Walensky is on Quest Diagnostics board. And Donna Shalala. Oh, gee, what a surprise. Donna Shalala. She's also on the Lennar board. And so you get these, and then you start looking at the boards of some of these companies, and you discover that, you know, these giant interlockings or interlinkings happen. For example, Donna Shalala is on the Gannett board, as is James Johnson, and they're both on the United Health board. And they're the guys who are setting the salary, the compensation for this CEO, for our good Dr. William McGuire, who's making $1.6 billion. And the Wall Street Journal looking at this going, you know, maybe we should be scratching our heads about this. In Minnesota, George Anders notes in the Wall Street Journal, in Minnesota, such riches have infuriated some people. Joel Albers, a Minneapolis pharmacist, regularly impersonates Dr. McGuire at state fairs, donning a tuxedo, holding up in a large picture of Dr. McGuire on a stick, and handing out leaflets denouncing corporate greed. Most people chuckle and walk on, but Mr. Albers says he has a serious point. He has been urging Dr. McGuire to spend his options proceeds on providing free health insurance for Minnesota's 77,000 uninsured children. The guy's worth more than $1 billion. He could easily insure every single child in the state. Ain't going to happen, though. So what is this bringing us? I got an amazing story of a friend of mine who's a physician who spent the weekend at our house. I'll tell you about it right after the break. What it really the an insight into how broken our system is. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Give a little bit. Give a little bit of your love to me. Give a little bit. Give a little bit of my love to you.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman. It's just amazing over at TheyRule.net. You just put in the two companies and you say, what's the connection? For example, between United Health Group, which is paying their CEO here over $1 billion, and General Electric, where Jack Welch was making hundreds of millions of dollars and, you know, made the high-paid CEO kind of king of the pile. Well, General Electric has Ralph Larson on its board, who's also on the board of Xerox. Xerox has Ann McCauley on their board, who's also on the board of Target. Target has James Johnson on their board, who's also on the board of United Health Group. Two skips of the rock across the pond, and you go from General Electric to United Health Group. And you can just plug in any old company name if you want to go from United Health Group, for example, to Halliburton. United Health Group has James Johnson on his board, who's on the board of Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs has Ruth Simmons on their board, who's on the board of Pfizer. William Howell is on the board of Pfizer, along with Ruth Simmons, and he's also on the board of Halliburton. Does the phrase ruling elite start to sound meaningful? It's really quite remarkable. An old friend of ours, Dr. Louis Malmadrona, spent the weekend with us this last weekend. He's got a new book out called Coyote Wisdom. He's the author of Coyote Healing and a couple of books. He's a Native American and a physician. He got his MD from Stanford University, got a PhD in psychology. He's a psychiatrist. He's also a professor of medicine. He was teaching down at the medical school down in Arizona with Andrew Weil for a while. He's up in Canada now teaching medicine. And he said, in order to get paid, you can't, as a doc, you can't just hang out a shingle anymore. You can't say, you know, I'd like to live in Portland. I think I'll go there and open an office. You can't do it. Because the local insurance companies basically control supply and demand. They determine how many doctors will be paid. I mean, you could open your office, but nobody would come to see you if you weren't being paid by insurance. So you have to be on their what's called their panel. If you've ever had a lawsuit, you're going to have problems. If you've ever had an interruption in your malpractice insurance, you're going to have a problem. If you have any ties to the alternative health industry, you're going to have a problem. You have to be pro-drug. You are referred to as a service provider unit, an SPU. And Lewis was talking about when he used to work for a hospital out east at one of the large famous hospitals. He said he was an SPU, and he had to quadruple his salary. Every hour, he had to make sure that he saw enough patients that four times his salary was brought into the hospital. And he said when he did the math on that, that came down to 6 minutes per patient. Assuming 1 minute to get from patient to patient. And you say, why would the health insurance companies want to limit the number of doctors in an area? Because you would think that that would drive up the price of the doctors. The doctors would be able to charge more. No, the insurance companies are such a monopoly. They simply say to the doctors, this is what you're getting. Tough luck. You know, you think you want to make $150,000 a year? Sorry, you're going to make $100,000. You want to make $120,000? You're going to make $70,000. He said the pay of doctors in his lifetime, he's been a doctor since the late 70s, has been going down steadily in real dollars. But you say, wait a minute, the insurance companies are like locking this thing up and they're reducing the number of doctors and particularly specialties in a town. Why would they do that? I mean, as I said, my first question to Lewis was, wouldn't that drive up the price of doctors? And he said, no, because they control entrance to the market. So it doesn't drive up the price. What it does is it drives down the availability. And that's something that they want. So when you call a doctor and say, hey, I got a problem. I think I need to see you right away. They say, fine, we'll see you in 6 weeks. And, you know, a certain percentage of people, 15, 20, 30% of people within 5 weeks are going to call up and say, a problem went away. Because there's this thing in medicine, you know, it's you'll get better in a week if you take this pill and you'll get better in 7 days if you don't. And doctors are forbidden from unionizing. There's a law that says doctors can't form a union, unlike nurses. I said, you know, the nurses are making more and more money. I mean, in some cities, in some areas, nurse practitioners are making more than doctors. How is that? He said, doctors can't unionize. It's just an amazing story. And, in fact, we'll have Lewis on the program here one of these days. In fact, Lewis himself, his wife got really ill. And the copays so whacked him that, you know, it kind of financially, it didn't wipe him out, but it, you know, cut him down to the point where he's still paying off the bills here years later after his wife had a major surgery because of the 20% copay. And he had full insurance. He's a doctor. Still paying off the bills. He said in Canada, it's a completely different thing. He's now teaching medicine in Canada, plus he's practicing psychiatry in Canada. And he said nobody tells him that he can or can't put somebody into the hospital. He said if you say that what you have is urgent, or if the doctor decides that what you have is urgent, you get into an emergency or into an operating room immediately. Yes, if you want to have a nose job, you may have to wait a year because you have to wait until an operating room opens up that's not being used for critical care. You know, but there's elective surgery going on all the time. And he said it's just incredible. Nobody in Canada is dying from lack of health care. And in the United States, we have literally tens of thousands of people a year dying in this country from lack of health care. And we got this guy who's the CEO of United Health making $1.6 billion, according to today's Wall Street Journal. A lot of Americans have to be looking at that going, what's wrong with this picture? $1.6 billion. I mean, we could fund the administration of a national health care program with this guy's salary. At what point do you say, enough already? You have enough money. But $100 million, $300 million, $500 million, $1,000 million, that's a billion, $1,600 million? This is just, you know, it's just fundamentally not a healthy thing. Bottom line. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Alan in Denton, Texas. Hey, Alan, what's up?
Yes, I was wondering about right-wing think tanks like Ayn Rand Institute, the Cato Institute, the Heritage Foundation, and the National Association of Manufacturers. Are they funded by tax-free by big corporations?
Well, the National Association of Manufacturers is a trade group, so they're definitely funded by their members. The Cato Institute, I frankly don't know. The Heritage Foundation was started by Joe Coors and Richard Mellon Scaife, I believe. I see their names and pictures when I go to the Cato Institute, or to the Heritage Foundation, rather, to debate conservatives on these panels that we do from time to time. So, with Ayn Rand is a small organization. It's mostly volunteers and they're mostly ideologues. The fact that they're not getting money from corporations, I think, is one of the reasons why they're willing to come on this program and basically tell the truth about, you know, hey, we don't believe in democracy and we think that, you know, corporations should rule the world kind of thing.
Okay.
Answer your question, Alan?
Yeah, I mentioned just a small list of them. I imagine there's a lot larger list of them.
There are entire websites. You know, citizen.org, Ralph Nader's group, Public Citizen, has done a good job. And Russell Mokaber's website as well, which I'm escaping me right now, but I'm sure you can Google his stuff, have done a really great job of outing some of these organizations, the Competitive Enterprise Institute, the American Enterprise Institute, who put themselves out there as being pro-capitalism, or some of the anti-global warming sites and so on, you know, where their funding is coming from, which corporations are giving them money. Most of the think tanks, if somebody from a think tank is showing up on network television or on cable TV, odds are they're funded by a corporation. That's kind of the bottom line. If, on the other hand, they're more, you know, ideological than not. You mentioned 501c3, you know, not being paid, not having to pay taxes. Yeah, some of them are nonprofit, and therefore they can take these donations from corporations. It's an abuse of the system, in my opinion, but it's going on.
Yeah,
Glenn in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Alan, thank you for the call. Hey, Glenn, what's up?
Well, I was watching the news this morning, and they were mentioning the fact that in the last 10 years, there have been 40 giant mergers of these healthcare corporations. And you would think that by eliminating the duplication of administration and paperwork, they would make a huge savings and pass.
And they
on.
Have. They have, but they're passing it on to their CEOs.
Exactly. Not only that, but their excuse is the same as Big Oil. Well, if we hadn't merged, and it would cost that much more.
Right.
In other words, they're doing us a favor by just keeping the prices going up a little.
Right. The people that they're doing the favor, Glenn, are the investor class and their CEOs, and that's the bottom line. Glenn, thanks for the call. Paul in Chicago. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Tom, hi. Thanks for taking the call. I just wanted to validate some of the points that you were making. I'm a physician, and I've been practicing for over 12 years, and I've been dealing with a lot of the issues that you're talking about. Well, one thing I'd like to make a point is that there was an article that came out of the New England Journal probably 3 or 4 years ago, and what it talked about was the overall health care that was dollars that was spent in the United States. I believe it was in 2001. That number was somewhere close to $1 trillion. It was $960-something billion that's been spent by the American public. They looked at how much is the actual cost of administrating the health care. And that number came up to something ridiculous, like about a third of that cost.
Right.
So about 300
in the private system. In Medicare, it's 3%.
Right. Well, that's what they were doing, is that they were talking about basically was the failure of HMOs to do what they were designed to do, which is limit the cost of health care. It's never done nothing but escalate since the conception of this for-profit type of structure. Now, they compared it to Canada and the Canadian model. And what they looked at was exactly what you're talking about. Here we have a corporation like United Healthcare or Cigna or Blue Cross and Blue Shield. Take your pick. They insure approximately the same amount of people that live in the entire country of Canada, a single-payer system.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it's time to go, huh?
Yeah, well, Paul, you want to...
Yeah, I'd love to hang
on. Yeah, hang on, and we'll pick this up on the other side. It's I thought your point was going to be a little shorter, but... We have hard breaks in this program, so when the music starts, we gotta take the break. It's 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be back. Our conversation about what's going on with healthcare in the United States, who's making money, and who's dying. Right after this, Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
No parachutes, a safety net, see one foot on the water to face these fears. Coming out strong, like it can't be wrong, I said, hey, I won't fall. No parachutes.
And welcome back, my friends. 10 minutes before the hour. Truth in Broadcasting, the Tom Hartman radio program for a change. We were talking to Paul in Chicago, a physician. You were telling us, Paul, about the article or the study that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine a few years back.
Yeah, what they were doing is they were comparing the cost of health care when it's administered through an HMO. And then what they did is they looked at the major carriers, and for instance, United Healthcare and Cigna. They looked at the number of insured lives that these corporations are managing, which is approximately equal to the single payer system in Canada. And what they looked at was the administrative costs. Now, the Canadian model back in 2001 employed approximately 1,200 people to administer health care to about 15 to 18 million people. The models that we have in the United States under managed care employ about 40 times as many. So we're looking at, you know, for instance, United Healthcare, which has 40,000 employees. And the point of having managed care is to try to keep the cost down, to try to manage physicians.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way that they can actually do that is, unfortunately, to have a layered bureaucracy to try to limit the actual administration of health care, because you have to have professional people trying to, you know, to manage professionals, which are physicians.
Right. Right.
And so it's just a system that perhaps in theory may have worked, but has just escalated into this thing where we're really paying investors off. And there's an inherent, you know, level of profit in these things that looks like to me about 30%.
I remember, Paul, when I was a kid in the 1950s, our doctor actually came to our house. I remember a doctor making a house call, And I remember that Blue Cross Blue Shield, which was the health insurance company that we always had because my dad worked in a union shop, and the local hospital that we went to, Ingham Medical Hospital, were both nonprofits. And that was by state law. They were required to be not-for-profits. Well, and now all these things have been privatized. They've all been profitized, and the cost of them has gone through the roof.
I would clearly agree with you, and I would clearly state that I think for-profit medicine, in a sense, is highly unethical. I think it should be eliminated. I mean, this is not just a business, and anyone who's involved in delivering health care to people, I think, will realize that.
Right. It's like having a for-profit police force.
That's exactly.
I mean, look at how quickly it'll get corrupted, or a for-profit fire department.
And that's not to say that hospitals and nurses and physicians shouldn't be well paid. They should. But the money isn't going to them. It's going mm-hmm. it's going to some type of a personal investing system.
Yeah, it's going of guys like this, like McGuire.
Yeah, just one more quick point. You know, yeah. Cigna sent me some literature about 5 years ago at the beginning of this century when they realigned the corporation, so to speak. They spent a lot of money on advertising. They spent a lot of money on a new computer system and streamlining the operation. And the letterhead that they sent off to the physicians who were part of the Cigna network. Basically, in that letter, they stated that they spent over $1 billion doing this, buying a new computer system. What is it? This is just PR. $1 billion of health care that could have gone to people who needed it, and instead, yeah. You know, that's just a euphemism. I'm sorry, in my opinion, for profits.
Yeah,
they probably spent $100,000 realigning the system, and the rest of it was pocket.
Yeah. For sure. It's a badly broken system, Paul. And in fact, they probably own stock in the company that provided them with the computers.
Yeah.
Or if they didn't, their CEO, their board of directors was probably interlocking.
Yeah.
Paul, I got to move along. Thank you for the call.
Thank
and
you. All right.
Excellent point you make. Steve in Woodby Island, Washington. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Appreciate your show. And I was out there gardening and listening to you taking apart some of the big corporations. I totally agree with this. I am a physician. Board-certified emergency, mm-hmm. and I retired because of all this stuff.
Hmm. Yeah, in fact, Lewis, our friend who was over at the house over the weekend, used to make extra money on the side working as an ER doc, and he said it's not there anymore. He said some ER docs are making $30 an hour, I guess, now.
Yeah, it was my last month working in a – what's happened in the rural communities is they – in Washington State, we can't get malpractice insurance regardless of your record and malpractice. So you have to join a national contract group like Team Health. These guys aren't even the HMOs or the insurance companies. These are strictly hiring companies for doctors.
Right.
And they want 27 cents of every dollar you make to buy the
cow
in order so that you can get this malpractice insurance that costs $12 a patient.
Right.
And I've got this stuff, and I realized, hey, it doesn't cover OB. And when you work in a rural community with one OB doctor that isn't always there, you deliver babies.
That's right.
And I said, wait a minute, you're asking me to go bare.
Yeah.
And I looked at my salary for the month, that month of May, it was about 3 years ago, and it was $38 an hour working night shifts and with heavy trauma, you know, 60-mile-an-hour impacts. And I said, this is nuts,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, there's a point at which you say enough.
It's enough. And I'm 61 years old, so I have many years of experience with the ER medicine.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided to work for the Navy instead after 2001. Then I found out they have the same corporate problems.
Oh, geez. So, we're privatizing all of our government functions now.
Yeah, they've got a corporate entity there that just didn't bother to fund its malpractice insurance for over a year and a half. I found out after the fact that I went bare.
Holy cow. Steve, we've got to wrap it up, but I appreciate your call, and thanks for the validation on this. There is something rotten in Denmark, right? There is something. Our healthcare system in the United States is so badly broken. We spend almost twice as much on healthcare as any other country in the world, and we still don't provide decent healthcare to about a third of our population. It's absolutely incredible. 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Our quote for the day from James Madison, the father of the Constitution, the, let's see, one, two, three, fourth president of the United States. He said, "I believe that there are more instances of the abridgment of the freedom of the people by gradual and silent encroachments of those in power than by violent and sudden usurpations." Boy, is that one true. James Madison, our quote for the day. I want to get into, as we continue on through this hour, we're going to get a report from Washington, D.C. We're going to be talking with, in all probability, Victoria Jones from the Talk Radio News Service. And we also will be having our Bioneers guest, Jason Clay. He's going to be with us shortly. But after that, or as we go through that, after that, we're going to be talking about the ongoing privatization. We've seen how, number one, the economy has been brought to the brink by the Bushies in the first hour of the program. In the second hour, how the privatization of the healthcare system is causing just an absolute disaster. We're going to get into what this is doing now to things like the Smithsonian, our public highway systems, how more and more corporations are figuring out how they can make money off the commons. Now, you know, they've got the consumers, you know, their fingers tightly around the throats of the consumers. Now, how can they get them around the throats of government or of, you know, of our elected representatives and squeeze money out of the commons? We'll get to that in just a minute. But right now, our Bioneers segment, founded in 1990, Bioneers is a nonprofit organization that promotes practical environmental solutions and innovative social strategies for restoring the earth and communities. Bioneers.org, their website. Our Bioneers guest this week, Jason Clay. He's the vice president at the Center for Conservation Innovation at the World Wildlife Fund. The website, WWF, as in World Wildlife Fund, US.org. Jason Clay, welcome back. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Great to have you here with us. You suggest that most wars are not being fought between countries, but within them. What do you mean by that?
Turns out that most of the armed conflicts around the world are actually states or countries trying to control people that live within their boundaries, people that don't necessarily recognize the existence of the states, people that have been around as distinct cultures for thousands of years. And most of these battles are actually over who controls resources. So things like timber, water rights, minerals, oil, etc.
So you're suggesting that most of that the real wars that are going on are the ongoing wars that certainly, you know, reached their zenith probably in the 1400s or began, you know, really aggressively in the 1400s. But, well, I suppose actually you could go all the way back 7,000 years to the quote beginning of civilization, the war of what we call civilization against indigenous people around the world.
That's right. And since history is written by the winners, you don't see the side of the people that in many cases didn't have writing even.
So let's rewrite that history right now. Tell us what is the story from their point of view.
Well, it's about people who want to have more say in their own destiny. They want to be able to speak their own languages. They want to be able to police their own areas. They want to be able to use their resources as they see fit. One of the things that countries have done is divide up and kind of make legal agreements about who owns what. So countries will separate who owns the water from who owns the land, who owns the tree from who owns the land, who owns the minerals from who owns the land. And most indigenous people, in fact, most ordinary people don't really see the world that way. But this is how states have come to control resources around the world as much as they have. Now, what's interesting is that to do this, legally, states have to write constitutions. And one of the things that's interesting, most people think that this is a kind of long ago phenomenon, but even since the end of World War II, there have been, I think on average, every country in the world has rewritten its constitution on average about every 5 years or so, with some countries actually doing much more than that. Now, what the rewriting is about is not, you know, who gets to vote or how the votes get counted or anything like that. It's really about who owns what.
And the goal, you say, of the who owns what is to wipe out indigenous people. And what about, you know, the middle class, for example, of the existing society? We're seeing, you know, this very clear war on the middle class here in the United States as a result of the World Trade Organization, GATT, NAFTA, these kinds of bilateral agreements, multilateral agreements.
Well, those are battles, I think, within a political system about who gets access to what and who gets to share power, who gets to share the benefits of an economy.
Mm-hmm.
What we're talking about in terms of indigenous people is more who has basic rights to things that they have controlled since, as far as they're concerned, since time immemorial. So it's the very ground they live on, the languages they speak, etc. In many countries, indigenous people are not allowed to speak their languages legally.
Right. In fact, we had laws like that here in the United States for quite some time.
Right.
Right up through the late 1900s. In fact, I think it was Jimmy Carter who finally passed the Native American Freedom of Religion Act or signed it.
Well, it's, you know, even when they're on the books and not enforced, I guess it's probably an improvement over some countries where they're on the books and enforced.
Right. Right. So we're speaking with Jason Clay. He's the vice president of the Center for Conservation Innovation at the World Wildlife Fund, the website wwfus.org. Jason is an anthropologist who studied cultures from Mexico, Central and South America, to East Africa. And Jason, Dan Quinn, for example, in his book Ishmael, does a great job of identifying the cultural dysfunction that we have. And people like Peter Farb, who wrote Man's Rise to Civilization back in the 1960s, one of the great ethnographic overviews, I guess, of Native American cultures from coast to coast, talks about, you know, what was.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't. There seems to be a conspicuous lack of literature about where do we go from here? How do we reconcile? Basically, the trial and error systems that indigenous and aboriginal people have developed over tens of thousands of years that place human needs above above property rights, basically, and with our modern so-called civilization.
Well,
what do we do?
I think that you've got to recognize a couple of things. There have been tremendous progress made in many areas in terms of how to provide food and basic rights for huge numbers of people on the planet. And for the most part, the indigenous people that I've talked to are not actually interested in building a wall between themselves and other people, but what they are much more interested in is in controlling the degree of integration and the speed of the integration.
But arguably, if you're talking to them, they're no longer, at least culturally, indigenous people.
I mean, well, they're not isolated, but they're still indigenous. I mean, basically, there's been contact between every human group and its neighbors for as long as there have been people. And in fact, it's the contact between groups that has often created the greatest advances in civilizations because ideas are exchanged, etc. And what indigenous people are now saying is that they want more control over how that happens, how fast it happens, etc., which they're not given when they're forced to become parts of states and give up their own identities.
Right, and yet at the same time, there's groups like Brown Gold out there. There's the newsletter that comes from the New Tribes Mission, ntm.org, I believe, is their website.
Right.
I wrote about them in my book, Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. I mean, this is an incredibly toxic bunch. Their mission is to convert every last indigenous or aboriginal person on the earth to Christianity so that Jesus can return.
Exactly.
And they're very aggressive, and they're being very successful. And it's kind of ironic to read, you know, their newsletter where they're writing about how, you know, please pray for this group because they don't realize that they are all sinners. They can't figure out why they need Christianity, you know, and it's like you're going, whoa, you know, what are we spreading around the world?
Well, now, and you raise another interesting point, which is that it's very hard to be up to speed on what is happening with the 6,000+ indigenous kind of language groups around the world. No single person can really do that very well, can keep track of all the things that are happening to people or what their situation is, what their crises are, etc. But a group like New Tribes actually has a network of people and is engaged actively with more of those groups than probably any other single entity on the planet.
Right, and their job is to destroy them. Think about what
the implications of that are.
Yeah, and their job is to destroy them.
And
or to transform them.
To put them out of business as distinct cultures.
That's right. And just make them all just like us. It's the,
right.
the you know, yes, we'll take you into our culture, is the velvet glove over the iron fist of a dominator culture. It's
and it's, you know, and we treated Native Americans in the U.S. very similar. We brought them into
this,
mission schools and to church-run schools often.
This is nothing new. Jason, we've got to wrap it up, but
okay.
I appreciate your being with us. WWFUS.org. WorldWildlifeFund.us.org, Jason Clay.
Thank you.
16 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
So nation cries. Oh, when the nation cries. It's here for time.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Time now for...
Now, the DeLay Political Death Watch.
Yes, Tom DeLay has raised $484,475 in the 6 weeks before he announced his retirement from Congress, bringing his total cash reserves to $1.4 million, which he can now use for his legal defense fund. Isn't that extraordinary? Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom, that's not a bad number, actually.
Yeah, can you imagine having a job where you the last few months of your job you can rack up $1.4 million for yourself? And then
I
just
know.
Walk away
I
with it.
I can't imagine such a job, because if I was, sign me up straight away.
Yeah, well, run for Congress.
I guess.
You got to be a Republican, though.
Yeah, you're right. Those Democrats, they just haven't got that sort of thing sorted out, have they?
Now, yeah, for sure. Victoria Jones, I noticed a weird reminiscence here. 3 years ago, George W. Bush was insisting that we were not going to go into Iraq. And in fact, he said, and I quote, oops, hang on just a second. Let me get this thing up.
You said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
I'm the person who gets to decide, not you. And then today he said...
Voices, and I read the front page, and I know the speculation, but I'm the decider, and I decide what is best.
I'm the decider.
I'm the decider. I love that phrase. I'm the decider. He sounded petulant.
Yeah, and but it's amazing that he's using the same language over a three-year period. I suspect within the White House that this is something that people are probably quite familiar with.
Oh, I would think so. I also thought it was interesting that he said, I read the front page, because I thought, well, maybe that's as far as he goes.
Apparently. Yeah.
Because I didn't think he even went that far. Well, you know, then Secretary Rumsfeld had a press conference in which he basically just talked and until the press corps nodded off. I mean, he just went on forever.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Well, you know, our Don Rumsfeld alert.
As we know, there are known knowns. There are things we know. We also know there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know.
Yeah, and so, you know, Don Rumsfeld.
Yeah, what is it? Absence of evidence isn't that evidence of absence.
Right.
That one.
Yeah, I think he took one too many EST courses back in the day.
He's
talking
it's
like,
amazing.
Yeah, he's talking like Werner Erhard.
It was one of the subjects of the White House press briefing today. There were two subjects today. One, Iran really wasn't a subject. One of them was gas prices. I guess a fair number of the press corps, like myself, drive in, and we've noticed it's been over $3 a gallon in this region for quite a while now. Mm. And the other one was Rumsfeld. And I asked what I think is a very reasonable question, and you'll be surprised that I didn't get a substantive or reasonable reply to this. But I simply asked, look, these are guys, they've fought, they've served, they're generals. How about if, has the president or Rumsfeld thought of maybe just, let's sit down and talk about it?
Hmm. Yeah, well, it doesn't, and what response did you get from Scotty?
We know their views.
Oh. Yeah. Well, I guess you do now.
Yeah, that's the end of it. There's no talking here.
Now, I'm curious, Victoria Jones, if this is something new in the American experience. I mean, as far as I know, you look at the history of generals essentially revolting against command structure, and in major westernized nations, the last one that I can think of was when the generals attempted to overthrow Hitler. And Rommel was told that he could commit suicide or be put on trial, humiliated, and murdered, and he committed suicide.
Right, exactly, which I think was a reasonable option in his case.
Yeah.
I can't think of a single case, really. I mean, this is pretty unusual stuff. It really is, despite all the attempts to portray it as it's just a few generals. Well, it is. It's only six or seven who seem to be speaking for a whole load of others. But it is pretty unusual stuff.
Yeah, six or seven or eight if you toss in Wes Clark, or nine if you throw in Zinni, or ten if you you go back to some of these guys who have simply been on the record for 3 or 4 years, so they're not part of the six of the week, you know.
Then you have to start wondering, are more going to start being brave enough to do it, and at what point, if at all, are the generals who are still serving actually going to speak? And I don't know that they're going to. I'm not sure that they would. But at some point, if enough people die, you have to wonder if they will.
I wonder, I know that one of the right-wing talking points is, consider the impact on the troops on the ground. And I'm sure that every single general, particularly those who are leading combat troops in Iraq, which is two of the six who came out, has to be thinking about what kind of impact is their talking about this publicly going to have on those troops. We're seeing desertion rates right now in the U.S. Army higher than they've been since Vietnam at any other point in our history except for Vietnam. Any evidence of anything else happening in the military?
Nothing that I've heard of, to be honest with you. You need to speak to Wendy, our Pentagon correspondent, for more details on that.
Yeah, well, if you hear anything, let me know.
Yes, I will.
Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, the website. Victoria, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Truth in broadcasting for a change.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Into the distance, ribbon all black, stretched to the point of no turning back. Flight of fancy on a windswept field, standing alone, my senses reel.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Truth and common sense in broadcasting. I'm Tom Harpin. You asked the question, how is it possible with Bush's approval ratings down in the 30s, how is it possible that any Republican can get elected in the 2006 elections? Well, actually, I would submit to you that George W. Bush has no concern about how bad his approval ratings go. He doesn't care. All he cares about is that the Republicans hold a majority in the House and Senate by hook or by crook so that he doesn't get prosecuted or impeached. That's all Karl Rove cares about. Karl Rove is looking at the possibility of hard jail time if the Democrats start investigating seriously some of the crimes of this administration. Don Rumsfeld looking at war crimes charges, Dick Cheney looking at war crimes charges. I mean, you've got serious, and Condi Rice as well, serious stuff. So how can the Republicans successfully run away from Bush? The answer, they don't. They run against him. This is already starting. And this is why, by the way, I have had a number of Democrats say to me, we need to start referring to the Bush Republicans and start painting all the Republicans with the tar of Bush, right? But my response to that is then you're doing them a favor. Because the Republicans will just start saying, well, I'm not a Bush Republican. I'm a straight-talking Republican. I'm a different Republican. I'm an anti-Bush Republican. they're going to run against him. It's already started. There is a United States senator who used to be a conservative talk show host and then was the head of and continued to own a part interest in right up until 2003 the company that owned the company that installed, programmed, and largely ran the voting machines that were used by the citizens of Nebraska, the state he's from, to vote for him. Back when Chuck Hagel first ran for the United States Senate in 1996, his company's computer-controlled voting machines showed that he had won stunning upsets in both the primaries and the general election. The Washington Post, January 13, 1997. Hagel's Senate victory against an incumbent Democratic governor was the major Republican upset in the November election. End of quote. According to Bev Harris of BlackBoxVoting.org, Chuck Hagel won virtually every demographic group, including many largely black communities that had never before voted Republican, the first Republican in 24 years to win a Senate seat in Nebraska. Of course, all the votes were counted on his own voting machines, and he did not reveal to the citizens of Nebraska that he was the president of the voting machine company. I wish it was the company that owned the voting machine company. He represented himself as an investment banker. Arguably, he was. 6 years later, Hagel ran again, this time against Democrat Charlie Matulka in 2002. You've heard Charlie on this program. Those of you who have been listening for years, Charlie, we had Charlie on the program in 2003 and 2004. Chuck Hagel won in a landslide. In fact, on his website at hagel.senate.gov, it says Hagel was reelected to his second term in the United States Senate on November 5, 2002, with 83% of the vote, which represents the biggest political victory in the history of Nebraska. Gee, what a surprise. Biggest victory ever on his own machines. 80% of them, anyway. As Charlie Matulka said to me, in January of 2003, he said, this is a big story, bigger than Watergate ever was. They say Hagel shocked the world, but he didn't shock me. I mean, Charlie Matulka's out there. He says, pretty straight up about it. In fact, Nebraska, after Hagel won, and it swept Republicans into office across the state, by the way, the Republican legislature of Nebraska passed a law that prohibits government employee election workers from looking at the ballots, even in a recount. A company has to do it. And the only machines that are permitted to count the votes? Hagel's company. As Charlie Matulka said to me, if you want to win an election, just control the voting machines. So Chuck Hagel now in the United States Senate, and he wants to be president. After all, if you own a voting machine company, you might as well become president, right? You got a kind of a direct line to things, as they say. But he has a problem. He's a Republican. In 96, it was very helpful to be a Republican. Now it's not. So, as I said, and I've been predicting since 2003, when nobody knew who Chuck Hagel was outside of Nebraska, that he would be the Republican candidate in 2008. Chuck Hagel today came out and began the process of running against George W. Bush. This from the Lincoln Journal Star by Don Walton, today's paper. Senator Chuck Hagel said Monday that he shares the lack of confidence in Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, separately voiced by six retired generals. Hagel said, the concern I've had is, at a very dangerous time, the Secretary of Defense does not command the respect and confidence of our men and women in uniform. There is a real question about his capacity to lead at this critical time, he said. I've had many conversations with military leaders about their concern about what's happening at the Pentagon and with our force structure. End of quote. Hagel says he first expressed a lack of confidence in Rumsfeld a year ago. Interesting. See, I'm telling you, Hagel says the president has that responsibility, responding to criticisms to the generals, and he's not asked for my advice on Iraq. This is the beginning of the Republicans running against Bush. And it's going to be fine with George W. Bush, because he knows that if the Republicans win, they will not investigate him, they will not prosecute him, whether it's criminally or whether it's for an impeachment. So Karl Rove is out there saying to Chuck Hagel and everybody else, yeah, go ahead, run against Bush, please. Because it's more important to get Republicans reelected than it is for George to be, you know, popular. And he understands that, too, because he doesn't want to go to jail either. I'm telling you, this is the beginning. This is the beginning. Dale in Kearney, Nebraska. On the speaking of Nebraska, hey, Dale, what's on your mind?
Good morning, Tom.
Morning.
Well, I just tuned in late and heard you talking about Nebraska.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm happy to report that I just came from our courthouse earlier this morning and had a lengthy discussion with our elections clerk, I believe is the name.
Mm-hmm.
They had three of the new machines sitting there in their office.
These are the ES&S machines?
Yes.
Yeah, because ES&S is the company that is the current name of the company that was the company owned by the company that Chuck Hagel was the president of.
Absolutely. They're domiciled right here in Omaha, Nebraska.
Yep.
And I tried to see if I could actually purchase stock in the company. It's a private held company by some major Republican players here in the state, one of
right.
which is one of our largest newspapers.
That's right.
But the news, I think the reason I called is the clerk has informed me that the new machines that they have will be giving a hard copy, paper copy of the ballot. And, of course, the reasoning for using these electronic machines is to help the handicap.
Yeah, but see, giving you a receipt, I mean, it's like, you know, anybody who knows how to program a computer can set up a little credit card reader, for example, and say, hey, come on by my convenience store and buy something, and you buy something, and I give you buy $10 worth of stuff, and I give you a receipt for $10. You go home and you look on your credit card, and you've been dinged for $20. I mean, just because you have a receipt doesn't mean it's real.
Right. I totally agree with you, Tom. In fact, that was the issue that I brought up to them. And everything they said is it's simply a copy or a printer. It's just duplicating on and on. In fact, I was invited to go watch a demonstration today. I'm hoping to be able to make that. But at least that's the story as it plays out here right now, and so I thought I'd share that with you.
Interesting. Well, Dale, thank you very much for calling and for sharing that. It's remarkable.
You're welcome.
From Kearney, Nebraska. Dale, thank you. This is amazing. So we've got the weird voting machine story. Our vote is going to be handled. Dale's vote in Nebraska, for example, is going to be handled by a private for-profit corporation that's not even publicly traded. You can't buy stock in it. This is how Hagel was able to run for the Senate without anybody knowing that he owned the voting machine company on whose machines they were, you know, they were voting. It's because it's a privately held corporation. And then, you know, to kind of put the frosting on the cake, after the election and after all these Republicans win, they'll be able to say, you know, the pundits will be sitting around going, instead of sitting around going, gee, all these Republicans were running, you know, supporting Bush, and everybody hates Bush, and so therefore, how did they win? It must be bad voting machines. No, instead the pundits are going to be sitting around going, oh, gee, I guess Hagel and those other Republicans, they developed a very good strategy of running against Bush this year instead of as Republicans. Instead of as Bush Republicans, they're anti-Bush Republicans or Bush anti-Republicans or whatever it is. And, yeah. You know, they're setting up the rationalization in advance. And this is, you know, not to say that the voting machines are all rigged. I frankly don't think they are. I think they're just hackable. I just think they're vulnerable. But it's the bigger issue is, why do we have private for-profit corporations, particularly ones operating in secrecy, handling our votes anyway? I mean, we don't have private for-profit corporations patrolling our streets. We say, you know, we want the government to run the police department. We'd rather have the government run the fire department. I think we should have the government, which is accountable to we the people, handling our votes. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I'm not.
And welcome back, my friends. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. 9.5 minutes before the top of the hour. 1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number. Wayne in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Hey, Wayne, what's on your mind today?
Yes, Tom. How you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better, Wayne.
I know that the talking point by the con seems to be that these kind of uprisings against the Secretary of Defense are unheard of. Last night I was watching a show on the Vietnam War on the History Channel, and they were talking about Operation Rolling Thunder, and I believe it was from 1968 or 1969, and they commented that the generals had such an uprising against McNamara that he resigned.
Yeah, yeah, but although it was entirely internal, I mean, it wasn't, none of them went public with this thing.
But it was still, it wasn't all of them lost.
Unless I'm misremembering my history. Wayne, these generals were not talking to the press. They were. This was an internal, basically they went above McNamara to Nixon and said, that's it. Am I recalling that correct?
Yeah, basically that's what they were
Wayne?
Saying. You
okay,
know, but the thing about here
is... I'm just not sure of the history on this thing, so I'll have to check it out. Ed in San Juan, California. Hey, Ed, what's on your mind today?
Tom, I hate to disagree with you, but the police are privatized in this country. Every time you go through one of those red lights with one of those cameras on it, they give you a ticket. I don't know if you have them in Oregon or not, but it's $250, and 130 of it or more goes to the private company that puts the camera up.
Oh, that's, really?
That's privatizing our police department.
So we have... Oh, geez, this is going on in the town that I live in. You know, we've got the red light cameras. I had no idea it was private corporations doing it, though.
Private corporation does it. Private corporation gets at least half the ticket. That's why it's about $250 where we live.
Wow. Amazing.
So the city, and they end up making millions. What I'd like to know is where the extra million goes.
Yeah.
How come that's in no budget someplace?
Well,
but it is privatized, Tom.
Yeah, but they're skimming it off the top of you and me. Amazing. Ed, thanks a lot.
Have a good day.
Yeah. Now, as I drive home past the camera, which brings us, by the way, to, as promised, the other issue that I wanted to talk about, which is the segue off the healthcare thing. Today's Wall Street Journal, again, page A4, with federal, state, and local governments facing budget squeezes, an increasing number of policymakers throughout the country are looking for ways to privatize highways, encouraged by Wall Street companies seeking lucrative fees in the deals. They talk about this really, really took a turn for, in you know, lurch in the direction of privatization in the last couple of years. A year ago, a private partnership paid $1.83 billion for the right to operate the 7.8-mile Chicago Skyway for 99 years. Since then, Indiana has leased its 157-mile turnpike for 75 years for $3.8 billion. Other states, including New York, New Jersey, and Delaware, have considered privatizing toll roads but haven't done so. Now, As Stephen Raddick, Harris County Commissioner, the guy, one of the county commissioners in Houston, he raises this question, and this is the question that everybody should be asking. He says, I always look at it this way. If you can sell them for tremendous profit, then why is someone buying them? Well, they're buying it because they know they can make even more money. Thank you, Stephen Raddick, Harris County Commissioner, for bringing some sense to this. The Wall Street Journal notes, initially the idea was promoted most aggressively by foreign companies, notably Marquee Infrastructure Group of Australia and Cintra Concesiones de Infraestructuras de Transporte S.A. of Spain, who worked together on the Chicago and Indiana deals and had done work on privatized roads in other countries. But appetites for such deals among U.S. investors appears to be increasing. See, these basically what they're doing is they're buying roads that you and I paid for, and they're buying them for a song. They're buying them for a fraction of what it would cost to build them today, to acquire the land, to build the highways. It's a fraction. Our governments are selling these things off in large part because, number one, conservative economics, these cons have been out there with these insane tax policies, and you have states that are starving to death. Here in Oregon, series of initiatives that have been passed by ballot initiative where the cons get out there and they basically, you know, rewrite the rules of economics for people and say, no. Taxes are not investments in the future. Infrastructure is not something that we the people own. You know, they've got, down is up and up is down. The caption here, and this article, Making Public Highways Private, in today's Wall Street Journal by Laura Meckler. The caption says, governments are increasingly turning to private firms to build, maintain, and operate new toll roads. More than $25 billion worth of projects have been proposed or are in development, according to a tally by the Reason Foundation. $25 billion worth. Private corporate. Why would a private corporation buy a road? Because they can make money on it. Then why don't we run that road? Well, because our politicians are willing to sell out, and probably after they leave politics, they'll get a good job at that private corporation. This kind of privatization, the selling off of America, whether it's our healthcare infrastructure, which now we've, you know, gone from nonprofit to for-profit, and instead we should have been going from nonprofit to government at least paid for, single-payer healthcare system. Our highways, I mean, we're looking at power systems around the country are increasingly going private. We saw what happened with Enron. Isn't that wonderful? Yeah, it's a great thing. And now the Smithsonian. They're privatizing the Smithsonian. They just cut a deal with Showtime, claiming that this is a business contract, doesn't involve federal funds. Yeah, right. Actually, the Smithsonian is publicly chartered, receives 75% of its funding from federal appropriations. And in this new deal, which PBS documentarian Ken Burns has just flipped out about, this new deal, the Showtime is gonna basically control all the content the Smithsonian has. It's incredible. This is and I would add, it's wrong. Tomorrow we're going to be debating with conservative Dominic Maglio. He says teachers are paid with tax dollars, therefore they shouldn't use classrooms as a bully pulpit to indoctrinate students. Oh, yeah, all right. Remember, friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.